It's Ken Bergen here, and welcome to the Hospo Reset podcast. Each episode, I explore trends, innovation, and smart thinking in the hospitality industry with a particular focus on restaurants, cafes, and food service. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with me on LinkedIn and on Twitter. Hello, it's Ken Bergen here from Hospo Reset, and today I'm talking to Paul Leach from GSE Business Consultants. He's also a business broker, and we're talking all about buying and selling cafes and restaurants. It'll be in an Australian context, but I think a lot of the principles are pretty universal ones, finding buyers and leading them along till there's finally a signature and making sure everything's very presentable in that process of getting your business ready for sale. Hey, Paul, great to talk to you today.
Hey, Ken, good to see you again. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so we talked about this topic a few times in the last few years, even pre-COVID. And yeah, it's a dynamic industry. Lots of things change.
Yes, but a lot of change over those 2 years, isn't there?
Yeah.
A lot of change.
And I remember when we talked early COVID in 2020, it was amazing, really, because we were kind of like business falling to pieces and the world seemed to be collapsing around us. And the demand for cafes and restaurants, as you explained then, was through the roof. It was that was a real surprise to me. Is that kind of demand still as strong as then, or how's it changed? Because we're early 2022 now.
Yes, like for everyone in the industry, it's been a roller coaster over the last couple of years. And I mean, where we're at the moment, so the market currently, it's probably the easiest way to describe it is patchy. It does depend very much where you are. Certain things have kind of turned on their head. So that the whole, if you go back pre-COVID, looking at CBD businesses, lobby cafes, those five-day businesses, they were highly in demand. Always very difficult to get those listings. They were easy to sell. It was good business. Now that's kind
Monday
of switched
to Friday,
around.
Daytime, have a business, have a life.
yeah. But those areas now that relied heavily on office environment, traffic and CBD locations, understandably, there's a big shift in the market as far as that's concerned. And I guess like talking about that period going back from when we spoke in 2020 to now, there's been a wave of a demand for the suburban cafes. That they were the guys that were really, and a lot still are, doing very well throughout the lockdowns and the restrictions and the people working from home. So there was a big uplift in demand for those businesses. And there was a period there where they were selling for a good premium. They were kind of on the crest of the wave. So through that period was very good for those businesses. What we're finding now is that people are, they're starting to back off a bit in relation to what they're willing to pay for that type of business. So still in demand, and much more so than the CBD locations. And the same applies to regional areas as well, in that there was that massive rush which led to an uplift in prices. The same with anything, supply and demand. Mm-hmm. That's now settling down a bit to a more normal market again. So the prices have come down, the demand has dropped a little bit. And if you look at regional areas, what happened in many places is that all of a sudden there was a big rush of people coming out of Melbourne, coming out of Sydney and the bigger cities, going to those areas, which forced the prices up, not just in businesses, but house prices as well. And people that we've been working with there, they've got staff that are struggling to find accommodation now because the prices have gone up. The holiday lets have all been
Yeah, this is something that doesn't get talked about enough. We talk about shortages of low-cost housing, and it needs to be low-cost because we don't pay people very much. But, you know, low shortages in cities, but regional areas. I was talking to a guy I know who manages aged care facilities, and in some large country towns, they've actually had to buy houses to be able to find accommodation for nursing staff. I mean, it's staggering, really. Just
consulting clients in regional areas that have done very similar things. They've, as part of the incentive to get people to relocate and move there and make it affordable on the wages that we know are going to be able to be sustained in the job that they're going into, they're doing the same thing. They're either renting or buying properties to house their staff. It is difficult.
New part of the equation. And when you look at job ads for country areas, they're talking about near the snow or near the surf or all these kind of groovy things, and say, yeah, but how much am I going to be paying in rent?
That's the thing. And it has, as I said, that spiked over this period. So in some cases, sort of 30 to 40%. So in those situations, obviously there's been a pullback in that. There is still a lot of movement. There's probably more movement of people now than I've seen in the time I've been doing this.
To regional coming areas. Out.
Yeah, regional areas, New South Wales, looking mid-North Coast, far North Coast, people relocating. Several of our recent sales in Brisbane have been people coming out of Melbourne. That seems to be a very popular place for people coming out of Melbourne, moving up to Brisbane. I think Brisbane and Queensland, there's been a lot of movement from New South Wales and Victoria.
Yeah, a bar and restaurant owner I know in Melbourne, because they had such tough lockdowns for so long, and he was just lamenting staff that he knew personally, people he was dying to get them back, and one after one they were heading to blue skies in Queensland. Now, some of them may come back, but some won't. It's I mean, that's been an Australian issue for many years.
Yeah, there's been a lot of people that we've worked with in Sydney that the motivation for selling has been to move to Queensland. So Sunshine Coast, Gold Coast, Brisbane, a lot of movement.
Interesting. And in those areas, are people paying unreasonable prices for businesses, or what's the demand for businesses on those kind of holiday areas, tropical, pleasant places to live?
I think most things, the price, they're not paying silly prices, but when you get a business that's in an area where people are looking to move to and you get two or three people interested, then it's much easier to drive the price, obviously, once you get a bit of bidding going. So that's what we're finding at the moment, is that the pricing is running, you're putting it in at the right price, you're generating more interest. And from that, you were selling, or just thinking of a Canberra sale recently, that went over $200,000 over where the vendor had accepted an offer through a private sale. So if you get the right environment, you can definitely get
a premium. There's a bit of emotion playing into all of that as well.
Yeah, especially when people have sold their house and they're moving state and they've got a family, it's definitely, you are able to get a premium, but it's not, I wouldn't say it was silly money. It's top end of the current market, I would say.
Interesting. So what's your background? You're in the kind of world of cafes and restaurants, and I think you do sporting things as well, don't you?
It's in my blood. Yeah. Yes. I grew up with parents that had, my dad was the first person in the area where we lived in the south of England to open a steakhouse. So he'd gone out to South Africa and seen the concept, and it wasn't a thing in England at that time. So he opened the first steakhouse. So that I would have been about 5 or 6 at the time. They had that very successful business for 10, 12
years.
Just
old enough to put the rubbish out.
I was old enough to work, yep. There was no dishwashers in those days either.
Yes, do your homework in the corner on table 12.
That's it, yeah. Actually, it's one of my childhood memories. I remember sitting under the bench playing with the tins. So, very, very true. So, but I was talking to somebody about that the other day. Fascinating how things have changed and consumer expectation, how that's changed. Back in the day, that was sort of 77, 78, around that time. And my dad did a promotion to get the business off the ground, which was if you bought a T-bone steak, you got a free carafe of wine or a free stein of beer. Now, he was actually brewing that upstairs. He was making his own beer and
really?
Wine. And you think,
wow.
In England now, you wouldn't get away with serving a T-bone steak, and you certainly wouldn't get away with homemade wine. But the market is definitely a very different place. But I grew up with that, with being involved in their businesses, 4 or 5 businesses when I grew up. And when they retired, I'd gone through and trained as a chef. It seemed a natural thing to go and work with them. And then they sold that business. And when they sold up, they were very kind and backed me in starting my own place, which was in 93. Mm-hmm. So it was my first place. And that was the first of 10 businesses that my wife and built. Or we either built from scratch and then sold, or we had them, we bought failing businesses and turned them around and sold them on. So we did that for just under 30 years, did 10 shops in that time. And throughout that period, obviously learned an awful lot about how to prepare a business, the pitfalls. I made some pretty horrendous mistakes and learned some very expensive lessons. So from that,
usually only once if you keep going, though, isn't it?
Yeah, once or twice.
No, I mean, you don't repeat the same mistake. You do other mistakes.
Well, no, I have repeated one twice, actually. But, you should definitely only make it once. So I'm a slow learner. But we kind of learned a lot about the process. And when it got to the stage where I didn't physically feel that I wanted to be doing what I was doing anymore, we had, in Australia, we had pie shops. So I was getting up 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. And you can only do that for so long, I think, before it takes its toll. And got to the point where I was ready to move on. And this, what we do now with GSE, which is specializing in helping people to maximize the value of their business and then exit, would just seem like a natural progression. So yeah, we started this would be about 6 or 7 years ago now. So that's where we're at. So it's a great way to stay involved with the industry that I love the industry. And it just allows me to, you know, still interact with people that I enjoy working with and use some of that experience and some of those mistakes, hopefully, to help other
people. And real credit to you, the Facebook group that you've got for cafe and restaurant owners, 4,500-odd members, I think it's a very lively place and it's extremely well run. There's no rubbish, no spamming. And it's, I guess, something that in the olden days wasn't available for us, that kind of forum with your peers and advice from peers. I mean, there's a time for professional advice, but oftentimes, I mean, I just watch sometimes, someone will say, where do I get someone to do a hood cleaning in Melbourne? 20 people give you advice. This is the real deal. So
it's great. And I like it for that. And we obviously built that from when the Facebook groups, we just got in at the right time with it, basically. As you said, we put a bit of work into monitoring and making sure that there's not too much spam. You have to have a balance between allowing a few things that give a bit of empathy, because as we know, it's a very tough industry, and sometimes it's just kind of nice to actually have a bit of a moan to people that understand where you're coming from. We all have days and times like that. And I remember with some of my shops, if you'd walked in on the right day, I would have just given you the keys and walked out. But I think to have a sounding board for new ideas or things that you're checking out or you're not sure about, it can be very useful. And I think now, other than moderating, I don't post in there as much as I did in the early stages, because it's got to the stage where everyone's helping each other, which is, I guess, what you ideally want from a community.
Yeah, it's an industry, usually, I think, of very secretive, very don't share numbers, don't share figures, and little by little that's changing.
It is. It's so much easier than it used to be for people to get information that you're almost better. Like, if people ask me, questions about how we work or how they should do something, I've got no problem telling them, because at the end of the day, you can get that information anywhere. There's no point guarding it or trying to protect it. It's been a very useful place, especially throughout COVID for myself. I found it actually helped me, because we pretty much lost our entire business over one weekend. I lost all of our consulting clients went on pause. We lost 7 deals that were in the pipeline. We lost 6 figures in a month. It was a pretty rough time. And we had no income, literally had no income for 3 months. So for me to be able to get in there and use my time productively to help people and offer support, I found it for myself on a selfish level.
You got support right back.
It was great. It really, really helped. And then I think that in turn led to us helping our recovery as we came out of the lockdown.
Now, you grew up in family businesses and all that involved. I mean, the good stuff and the tough stuff sometimes. And I'm just thinking about people who are, well, both buying and selling family businesses. I mean, on the one hand, you've got free labour, and I definitely remember using that, but you've also got this sort of weird amount of control. And there's also that other side that there's some very professional, say, managers or chefs or something, you say family business and they say no thanks. Just before we get into more on buying and selling businesses, what are your kind of observations on, say, someone who's wanting to sell their business and it's been run by husband and wife maybe, or two partners and a couple of kids, and there might be a brother-in-law floating around somewhere, and is there any particular things that we need to simplify there?
I think it's really important to make sure that, and this applies to any business really, but in this kind of situation, then there's an element of risk perceived by the buyer, in the respect that they don't think that any family member is likely to stay on once the transaction's gone through, and in many cases they don't want to stay on. If they do want to stay on and you're using that as a selling point, you need to make sure that in the figures that are presented, that the wages represent true market value and what it would actually cost to replace that person. So if you've got a family member, as you said, that's free labor or being paid less, you need to, when you work your numbers out, make sure that's allowed for. And the same goes the
person
the other
who
way.
Does the bookkeeping or whatever.
The bookkeeping, to be honest, I personally, I just leave that in. I don't worry too much about that. It's more if you've got, let's say you've got somebody that's a manager, and there's a couple that own it, and it's the son or daughter that's the manager. You need to make sure that if that manager is being paid less than the replacement costs, there's an allowance made in the profit declared. And the same the other way as well. If they're getting paid twice as much, you can take an add back on that. So it's about presenting it in a way that's clear financially. And then on the operational side, you want to make sure that those roles are clearly clearly documented so that that manager, if there's a perception of risk of that manager leaving in that example, you can overcome that objection by saying, well, look, even if they do leave, here's all the documents, here's how everything's done. And by the way, we've also got a 2IC trained up that can step into that role. So
do you see people, you can never guarantee that anyone stays, but do you see any kind of key staff being given some kind of incentive to stay for a certain period? Or do you is that a tactic that would be advisable?
Sometimes? Yeah, it can definitely be a part from the seller's side where there's an incentive position. When you have the conversation with key staff members about the sale process, then you know, one of the things you can do from your side is you can, if you choose or you feel that's necessary, you can offer an incentive for them to be there through till the end of the sale. But the interesting thing I find from
or longer that, for 6 months, would that work, or is that getting a little bit extreme?
For what, sorry, Ken?
Or say if you're there in 6 months after I've sold the business, there'll be also another bonus.
I think it's more common to see people make an agreement with their staff up until the point that they sell.
Right. Okay.
And then after that, it's really down to the new owner because you don't know how that owner's going to treat them. You don't know how that relationship's going to go. And you know,
I've always said to people that, look, just the fact is within 3 months, they'll all be gone. So if someone's selling you a business and saying, oh, the staff love it, they love or love working here, they love the customers and all the rest,
Yeah. So we get, obviously, we're dealing with both sides. On the person, when we're acting for the client that we're working for, the person selling the business, there's always a big concern about staff finding out and when should we tell them and or we don't want them to leave, which is natural. But the thing to bear in mind on the other side of the deal, the buyers, we're always getting asked, the question you always get asked, or one of them is, will the staff stay?
Yeah.
And my answer to that is that as the buyer, you have more control over that than the person selling. How you come in, how you introduce yourself, how you interact, position what you're going to do, and ultimately how you operate in those first few months, that has way more control over anything in relation to whether staff will stay or not.
It's really onto them.
Yeah, but it's good for people in the selling position to communicate that to the staff that really, in most cases, if you've got a successful business, then the person buying the business is going to need the staff more than the person selling the business because they're coming in, they've got to learn the ropes, they've got to get to know everyone there, the suppliers and the systems and everything else. So the staff are, in many cases, more valued by the person buying the business in the early stages.
I remember selling my cafe and I did a pretty good job keeping it secret because I really wanted it to be top secret. And the milkman somehow found, I have no idea why, and leaked it somehow, but it was right at the end of the process, fortunately. But, I mean, do you advise secrecy or does it depend on different factors or what's...
It's case by case and it depends even staff member by staff member based on your relationship with them, how long they've been with you and how much risk you think there is to the business. But in the early stages, there's no point rocking the boat. There's no point telling anybody because, you know, with the best will in the world, it takes a while to get to the point where you've got a serious party involved. But my preference when I sold my own businesses was at the point where there was interest and there was people starting to come and look at the place, that I sat them down, the key staff members, and told them what the plan was and what was happening and put them in the picture. And that way, the situation with the milkman you described, or when we communicate with people, we always say it's in the non-disclosure agreement, it's in the information memorandum, it's in the emails we send them, it's in the conversations we have with them. But you still get people, and believe it or not, people that have been in the industry and might even own their own shops that go and they do the wrong thing. So you do as much as you can to prevent it. But it's a reality that at some point somebody's going to let it, as happened with you, they're going to let it out of the bag.
So let's, I mean, we're talking to two bunches of the buyers and the sellers here. Let's talk about people buying it first up. But what do they generally find? Let's say this is their first business buying. What do they find the most sort of surprising or challenging about the whole process usually? Maybe they've, you know, worked in a kitchen or worked in as a waiter once upon a time, but this is their first business. What shocks them or surprises them?
I think there's several things. I think sometimes it's easy to go into it with the rose-coloured glasses in the respect that you haven't really thought things through clearly. You haven't really got a good idea of how much the business is going to need to break even, whether the market is going to want what you're thinking of doing. If it's an existing business, it's always interesting what information people ask for at what stage. So a lot of people get wrapped up in the financials early on before they've even looked at the lease. So if you're a new buyer, you know, you need to be looking at the lease document as a priority, because it doesn't matter how good the financials are. If the lease is no good, you've got no business, ultimately.
And what does no good mean to you?
It could be something that's a short term, or it's got an aggressive demolition clause. Short term is a worry.
So are we talking a few years or 5 years or what?
Yeah, you see some that have got less than that. So it might be two or 3 years left. But if the person selling the business has done the right thing, they will have extended the lease, or they would have checked through all of that and got that in place. So it's a good idea to make sure you've got a decent term, that the rent increases are sustainable. And I know something else that we spoke about offline was throughout COVID, going back to that COVID period, what's the landlord done throughout COVID?
Yeah, that's a good, because normally the landlord's just regarded as this inert bank account, really, aren't they? With almost, you have nothing to do with them, but now they actually had to be very involved in their tenancies.
It is a question that we're getting asked a lot, actually, at the moment. Throughout COVID, what happened? And when you're looking at appraisals at the moment, you've got to take those things into
account. That's quite a smart question for a purchaser to be asking,
Yeah, it is, because naturally, everyone's still a little bit nervous. They're a little bit on edge at the moment. If it happens again, what am I likely to get benefit? Am I likely to get a reduction from the landlord? So those lease terms and getting some insight, if you haven't done it before, is probably a very good.
Have deals fall over because the landlords were too tough or too inflexible?
Landlords now are, and that's another thing as a new buyer that a lot of people overlook, is that it's not about you putting forward what you want from the landlord. It's about you proving yourself to the landlord. And that's definitely tougher than it's been. Understandably, landlords are nervous as well. And ultimately,
raising the bar as to the type of...
They're putting more effort into vetting people and to checking the assignments before they're granted. Rewind a few years and it was a pretty straightforward process. We're actually a lot more hands-on with that than we ever have been. And we've changed our process around that to basically make sure that if we're putting somebody forward, we've gone through as much detail as we can to present them to the landlord in the right light.
Right.
So there's less room for the landlord to say no.
Bit of a beauty parade, and they've got to have hair and grooming, and
they've got it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they've got to tick the boxes.
Financial grooming.
Ultimately, the landlord's well within their legal right to say no, and they do say no. It does happen.
And it's a real issue. Again, way back when I sold my cafe, but I became a landlord for a few years, and there was one particularly shocking tenant who, you know, had been sold to them by someone else, and oh boy, world of pain.
Well, that's right. It's no good for anyone, and even agents now seem to be doing their job more diligently than ever in checking references, in going through financials. So you need to, again, if you're buying for the first time and you need to be aware that there's a bond as well. A lot of people overlook that, and the bank guarantee.
Is those bonds getting longer or bigger? Or
it depends on the experience. So that's one of the objection tools that you can use or you can offer. If you are not with as much experience, then if it's a 3-month bond and the landlord has concerns, you can offer to pay a larger bond to put the landlord's mind at rest. But typically 3 to 6 months is that's majority of what we see.
It's quite a lot of money too, isn't it, to factor into the purchase price? So people selling, first time selling the business, they've run a good business. It's like it's a job and it's a lifestyle and all the rest. And now something changes, maybe health or just suddenly they fall out of love with it all or something. But what are some of the surprises that they find about the whole process, and how do you kind of get them into shape and ready to look good?
Yeah, so I think I use the analogy all the time. It's a bit like running the kitchen. It all comes down to mise en place and preparation. So if you want good service, smooth service, everyone's happy and you're getting good reviews and all the staff enjoying themselves and having a good time, then you have to be well prepared for that. You've got to be well stocked and well prepared. It's the same with the sale process. So that work that you put in at the front end is really, it pays dividends as you go through the transaction towards the end. So the misconception is that the time-consuming part is dealing with all the time wasters and tire kickers and inquiries and so on. But the reality is that's, if you do it properly, it's actually relatively straightforward. You can get qualified
The broker, if they're using a broker, should be filtering out those people anyway.
Yeah. But even if you're selling on your own, if you word the ad correctly, give enough but not too much information, and you put steps in to qualify people early on, you can get rid of the time wasters very quickly. Mm-hmm. Even if you're selling on your own, you just ask them, you know, you just create a non-disclosure of your own from a template online. Asking people to complete that is a straightforward process, yes, but it gets rid of 30 to 40% of inquiries. So that's simple things that you do like that,
yes,
qualify people further. So that side's relatively straightforward. What most people don't appreciate is that after offer is really, that's the most risky point, and that's where most deals fall over, and that's where most good brokers earn their money. It's not the front end.
So, getting them from the offer, but there's no signature yet. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. So taking them from offer, and there's obviously a bit of work around a decent negotiation with the offer, but putting that to one side, the misconception is that once the offer's received, it's all plain sailing. The reality is that the little bit of emotion that there is with a business purchase has gone by that stage, and the logic all kicks in.
And that's when all the friends and the worried relatives all swoop in and, oh, my God.
It's when the accountant gets involved, and that's when a small piece of me dies every time I hear that, because no accountant, you know, most accountants are really worried about clients making decisions, and they're not commercially minded as their clients are in some aspects. That side of things, taking it from offer through to settlement is definitely the part that is, it's risky and it needs to be navigated carefully.
So does it just mean being very fast to answer questions? Is it just kind of speeding up?
Yeah, so going back to that preparation and the planning, ideally it's making sure that all of the numbers you present in the advert make sense. You can back them up and you can provide supporting documents quickly and efficiently. So all of the front end of what we do is all around that. So it's essential that you keep the momentum up once you get somebody interested and they've put an offer forward, and that you get your solicitor on it as quickly as possible, and then that you're literally following up with that solicitor almost daily to make sure the contract goes out and that it's being negotiated, and that every day there's something happening. It's moving all the time.
Okay, right.
Otherwise, there's creep doubts in. People start second guessing themselves. Are we doing the right thing? And until that contract's signed, and even after it's signed, it's not guaranteed.
Yeah.
So you've got to really that's an answer, a very long answer to your short question. That's the piece that I think most sellers.
Yeah. No, aren't aware I think that's very interesting. That whole it's kind of like a romance of some sort, isn't it? In a way. Yeah, and so are figures better quality for people now with better bookkeeping and more integration with point of sales? And I mean, obligations, you've got to have your payroll online and with done every week. And is that actually creating better, more reliable, more believable books?
It is, 100%. Mm-hmm. It's getting to where it should be now in that you can cross-reference and you can cross-check POS transactions with FPOS settlements, with zero figures, with everything matches up. If you've got, the thing to remember with the sale process is that it's all about minimizing the risk in the mind of the buyer. That's all it is. It's not rocket science. So if you're telling people that you're taking 20 grand a week and they look at the P&L and it says 12 grand a week, obviously they're going to be asking a few questions.
And then I think most of the other things you told them are probably porkies as well.
Yes, I mean, very true what they say, isn't it? People buy from the people that they like and trust. So if you lose that trust, you're on the back foot from the start. So that part of the front piece, getting everything prepared and making sure it's where it should be is correct. Presenting accurate figures. And as you said, with FPOS now and bank statements showing the settlements of FPOS, point of sale reports, it's never been easier to do that.
Yeah. And the buyers will still have those ideas they have. Oh, I could fix that. And oh my God, they're not doing this. I could do that better. Well, good on them. And maybe they can with some of it, but it's got to be based on, believable figures. And
there's a very true saying in the industry that the cash only comes out once. So if you're taking cash out, and not many people, to be honest, I mean, not many people are now. There's very little cash about. Uh-huh. It's nearly all on the books, because even since COVID, that's gone up. And it's another sort of 5-10%. But if you are taking cash out, then it's going to come out on a week-to-week basis or a monthly basis or whatever you do, but it's not going to come back in the sale. People are going to discount that when they start digging into it. And the other really important thing to consider with that is that you don't know who you're talking to. If you are disclosing information about that type of thing to buyers, bear in mind that they can report you. And I have seen that happen. I have seen it
really?
Happen.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Where I had a deal where there was a lot of cash in the business. The buyer obviously had visibility over that. And then he actually got stitched up by the vendor. And the first thing he did was go to the ATM. So it does happen.
Yeah,
does happen.
Wow.
So anyone I talk to that there's a cash element, the first bit of advice is put it back in. Don't do it.
Yeah.
It's just not worth it.
Interesting. Are there more reliable financial benchmarks available? Because you see, and I guess it's a sign of the naive buyer there saying, what should the profit percentage be? And not even saying what type of business. Is it a Mexican place or a cafe or whatever? But is there more useful advice? Because, I mean, the stuff that was being available from the Australian tax office has been, I think, pretty unreliable. Maybe not. Reliable is not the word. It just doesn't seem to reflect reality very well. What's your advice to people?
I think the interesting thing with that is that information is from reported figures. So it's not, in many cases, it's not accurate. And I think really, as you said, depending on the type of business that it is, whether it's a restaurant, and even if it's a restaurant, is it quick service? Is it fine dining? There's so much variance there in those numbers and in those margins that I don't know about benchmarking from other people. In some instances, I think you can get confused and you can think, well, actually, my margins are no good, or my margins are really good, and be off the mark. My preference is to use a method of consistently trying to improve the margins of your own business.
Benchmark it against yourself.
That's right. So I do that with my business as well, as well as my clients. You track monthly how you're going. And you set targets and goals, but you have to balance, especially in hospitality, you have to balance margins like wages and food costs to the point where you're not losing quality of product and quality of service. So it's no good striving for a 30% food cost if the chef's being forced to buy poor ingredients that ends up in a lower top line. So it's my preference is to look at, if you've bought the business, what's it been doing? Can you improve it? And how far can you tune that to the point that it's where it's comfortable on both of those sides without compromising service or quality? And then you start driving the top line.
What about the, let's call it the tech stack, or just the kind of the digital controls of the business, which now are often, there's quite a variety from rostering and bookkeeping and point of sale and bookings and staff management and all those things. Is there an expectation with a lot of buyers that this is well developed? Or because I remember, again, selling my own cafe way back, we did paid all our wages directly into people's bank accounts, which was pretty revolutionary back in the 90s. and that terrified one woman who absolutely had the money and loved the business, but it's like, oh my God, no, I couldn't do that. So yeah, I lost her. But now what is that a plus to have that well developed? Or
look, I think for your own sanity as well as the saleability of the business, the better the systems and the processes are, the easier it is for you obviously to manage and run the business. You can be more efficient, and it does make it more saleable. Again, it's reducing the risk in the mind of the buyer, in the respect that you're saying, well, look, here's a SOP with everything. This is how we run the business. So you've set it up like a franchise, but you never franchise.
If you use this thing called a mobile phone, you can watch the security cameras, you can watch the point of sale, the transactions and the wages and
I think the only thing that I've noticed with that is that you do, like, when you, obviously in this line of work, you go through a lot of businesses' profit and loss statements, and I go line by line and I dig into detail on that. The subscription line in many businesses is out of control, because these companies are very good at saying it's only $29 a month. And you think,
bucks,
well, $29 a month, that's I can easily afford that. And you get subscription creep. And I've had that in my own business.
Me too.
I do a reset every two or three months.
suddenly it's $200 or $300 a month, possibly.
It really does add up. And some of those, I'm not taking anything away from any of those apps, but you've really got a question. The way that I do it personally is I add it up. What's it going to cost me over a year? So when you look at it annually, it's a bigger number.
Okay.
It makes you think about it differently. Then you think about, I actually use visualization and think about $100 bills on the desk. That's how much it is.
Okay.
Do I want to spend it on that? Is
with
it worth it? Or can I do it? A lot of the things I was spending money on, I've got a guy, a contractor who's really good with Excel. And I replaced a lot of apps just with spreadsheets, to be honest.
Yes.
Because you can see a lot of, especially things like POS systems, $80, $100 a month. Then you add Deputy onto that. It's interesting. You've got to work out how much time it's saving.
Bring all the data together. That can be another $49 a month.
You have to be careful with that. But, I don't think there's ever been a better time to be in business with the tech that's available. It's phenomenal. Yeah, the information you can get now, it's incredible.
I've got all my numbers nice and squeaky clean and well organized and transparent. In fact, I'll even give you my Xero login details if you want to go through everything. What other things do I need physically to make my business more saleable? What are the buyers when they walk in? Obviously, it's got to smell nice and a nice sort of buzz as well. Well, what are some other physical things that people maybe often don't think about doing to prepare the business?
Yeah, and it's a good question. So, one side of it is all that, the paperwork, the documents, making sure the lease is all where it should be, the financials and so on. But another thing that you tend to see happen, and I actually had an experience with this yesterday, I had somebody ask me to approach a business on their behalf. And he said, he hasn't posted on socials for a long time. He hasn't updated the website for 7 years. This guy's over it. And it is a signal. You're sending a signal by not doing, not staying on top of your social presence, not staying on top of pushing the business. And even the digital presence is really important now. That type of thing is really important. And a lot of people overlook
that. Because that's the stuff you can check without even going into even standing outside the business.
You could, you go in an ideal situation, and this is, it's so easy to say and so hard to execute, but when you go into the process of selling, you need to run the business like you've just bought it and you're in love with it again and you're not over it. And that needs to come across to the customers, it needs to come across to the staff, needs to come across online, because you don't know who's looking at you. As soon as you go into the sale, that's it. You're going to be under more scrutiny than you are now. There's no doubt about that. And people make a decision very quickly. And even the points that you raised there about cleanliness, things that need doing, things that need fixing, people will honestly make objections and write businesses off. And most people, bear in mind, most people are looking at multiple businesses. They'll write things off, and we'll follow up with people, and they'll write it off over the most minor details. So it needs to present well. In the way, if you were selling a house, you're doing an open inspection. You're doing an open inspection every day when you're on the market, because customers are likely to be buyers.
Selling my house a few years ago, when we paid a few thousand dollars to have it staged, as the term is, where they actually took out some daggy furniture, which we loved, and stored it, and put in a glass top table because that makes the room look bigger. And my office was turned into a kid's bedroom. And I still work there.
It's a thing.
But it worked.
Yeah,
bloody
it does
hell,
work.
It really worked.
It does. Even as simple as cleanliness and paint. Somebody walks in and immediately they see paint flaking off the walls, or broken floor tiles, or thing that that's dollar signs to them.
Dirty
straight
tiles,
away.
Dirty tiles, dirty timber work.
Ideally, you look at it objectively, and the whole process, as much as you can, and even ask friends or people that you know are going to give you a straight answer, look at the business objectively as a customer, as a buyer. If you were buying that, what would worry
you? Get one of your bitchiest friends to come in and say, okay, back to front.
Yeah,
what
that's it.
What did you see?
But it is useful, and it's difficult sometimes because we all get very attached to the business, and people are attached to it. They become like your, extended family. The business is like a child in some respects. And you have to be, careful about how you position it. But you need to think about
Don't
it as a buyer.
Don't insult my child.
I've got rid of all my children now.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we're circling around, we're getting all the elements together. And now how do we put a value on a business? Obviously, the profits an important part of it, but there's some emotional factors which we've talked about as well, but it comes down to kind of formulas and things like that. Can you give us some guidance on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's pretty straightforward, to be honest. It's based ultimately on a multiple of the net profit, adjusted net profit. And what that means is that you're going to go through your profit and loss in detail, and you're going to work out if in the case of a smaller business, let's say that's up to 25, 30,000 a week that's owner operator. What if I buy the business from you as an owner and I work a reasonable working week, what can I expect to earn? What's the profit? Mm-hmm. So any expenses that you might be putting through in relation to tax reduction, and most people are doing that, they would be what's classed as an add back. So in conjunction with your profit and loss, you're working back a schedule of add backs to give you an adjusted
EBITDA. The extra superannuation you're paying or things like that. Or
yeah, so basically anything that wouldn't be passed on to a
those fancy research holidays to Europe.
Yeah, entertainment is usually a very popular line in P&Ls. Yeah, lots of things like that. Different, you see all sorts of things. So again, it's a balancing act. You go through that, make sure you've got it documented, ready to prepare to people, because if you're telling them it's making $3,000 a week, $4,000 a week, whatever, and the profit and loss doesn't say that, it's good to have a supporting document to show them how that adjustment's been made and what those figures are made
up. So we worked out what the, with their ad backs and everything, what the net profit's going to be for me, and what sort of multiples are we looking at, say, for a cafe or a restaurant, 5-day, 7-day business?
Yeah, so it depends. There's a number of factors, and that's probably a whole podcast on that, but there's probably 8 or 10 different factors that will determine where you sit on that multiple. In rough terms, in hospitality, cafes and restaurants, typically it's between 1 and 3 times net profit. One of the biggest drivers of that are going to be, the amount of net profit that you've got. That's because that's the number you're going to multiply. So that's a big driver of value. Also, what percentage is your net margin? That's a number that not many people track or look at. So if you're running an industry best practice net margin, then that drives you higher on that multiple.
Because that's a sort of signal that this is a well-run business.
Exactly.
And a sustainable business. What would we look at for
if you're at 20 or 20 plus or even close to 20, then that's pretty solid. That
shows you're really running a tight business.
Yeah. And that, you know, from a sales point of view, is a really strong selling point, because obviously you are generating more profit, which makes it a bigger business. But that margin.
And you've got a bit of resilience for all the ups and downs that's been happening in the last, there's not just COVID. I mean, we're going through horrific rain, storms and floods and things at the minute. That's it.
You've got to be prepared for anything, literally, at the moment. You don't know what's happening next. So that side of things is very important.
And the lease, the length of the lease.
Is going to determine that. Yeah, that's going to help to again, if you think about it like a sliding scale, these different things. So you've got high net margin, but the lease isn't as good. It's going to bring it down. And you're kind of playing around with that. The current market in your area, because you can't, it's not even national. Like the market's totally different. If you compare Victoria and WA, you know, it's two different markets. So you can't go off a national average. It's very specific. And even New South Wales, that's a different market in different pockets. So where the current multiple sits in your area or the range of multiple will be a big factor in that as well. How much you work, like if you're, and so you've got to think about it sometimes. When you're a smaller business, sometimes it is a job. You're buying a job, albeit that you can increase the value of that job.
That must be a common misconception from a lot of people who I think they're just going to, you know, get a good manager in, quote unquote. You must disabuse them of that fairly early, I guess.
Yeah, and you can definitely do that. And if you do that and you're successfully running it under management, then that pushes the multiple. It's a more attractive proposition. So the profit might come down because you're paying more in wages, but you'll be able to command a higher premium, and the business ultimately would be more attractive. But if you're a working owner, the difference between somebody that's doing 70 or 80 hours a week down to somebody that's doing 30, again, is going to drive the value higher if the business is running successfully with you doing less. Most people recognize that a smaller hospitality business has to be an owner operator, and if they don't recognize that, usually they're a buyer that will fall over, because we all know that it has to be up to a certain point. It's virtually impossible to get it fully under management and running the way you want it to.
Very interesting. Great stuff. This is so interesting. Why use a broker? Why not do it yourself? And I mean, you've already told us about that process where they've expressed interest and they're close to a signature and keeping that momentum up on a daily basis. I think that's certainly something I don't want to get in. I want someone to do that for me. But what else does a broker bring to the table?
Oh, I think I'd probably put in there a good broker. You know, a good broker will have connections that will be looking for the type of business that you might have. So you stand more of a chance of getting a quicker sale if you've got the right person engaged in the job.
And what's the sign of a bad broker?
Well, somebody that doesn't, maybe they don't follow up, or there's a lot of people out there that make money from listing businesses and not selling them. So if you've got somebody that's got, in my opinion,
it's just a directory,
more than 20 listings, you can't look after that properly.
Yes. Yeah.
When it's busy, you get swamped with inquiries and you can't follow up with everybody. So a good broker is somebody that's consistently getting results, whatever the market's doing. So you look at the shift throughout the last couple of years, people are still getting results regardless of what the market's doing. It's a fair sign that they know what they're up to. The way that we choose to work is we specialize in one industry, because I think selling a cafe, selling a restaurant, a food business is quite different to many other businesses. And having that niche database, if it's a good broker, is a strong reason to go with a broker. Mm-hmm. In many cases, it depends on the size of the transaction. So a lot of people that I talk to, brokerage isn't the best fit for them. It's not the best fit, because if it's a smaller transaction, that if it's a good broker, they're going to charge a reasonable commission, because why would they work for less, right?
You know,
There's the way I look at it, there's a limit to how many businesses you can look after as a good broker. So if you've got 15, 20, that's probably top. So you have to protect those slots and only bring on good businesses.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe get your accountant or your lawyer really, you're going to have to pay someone to do some work. And maybe the lawyer is the one, if there's someone who's going to return phone calls quickly and be available.
If you're selling on your own, you mean?
Yeah.
If you're selling on your own, then the solicitor, you need them on board and the accountant on board early on to get the business prepared and valued and get the lease and everything checked out. But once the transaction's rolling, if you're selling on your own, it's down to you, and how that sale goes is purely on your shoulders. There's lots of things you can do, and we've got plenty of resources to help people selling on their own, because I'm a big advocate for it in the right circumstance. Depends on the deal, depends on the business, depends on the owner. We've got some people that have never done it before that are happy to have a crack on their own, and we'll happily point them in the right direction as far as that's concerned. But a lot of the sort of mid to top end of the market are people that just, they've done it before, they've done it themselves, they know now what's involved, they don't want to do it again. There's a lot of people that have done it once and wouldn't do it again. And I think when we're less involved emotionally, we can protect the value of our clients' businesses in a stronger way. We don't get drawn into the emotional side of it, which if, as I said, it's your baby and something you've put blood, sweat and tears into and people are ripping it apart and lowballing you, then it's very easy to get emotionally drawn into
get offended.
Yeah, the vendors and the buyers can fall out quite easily, whereas with us, you get fairly thick skin in this game.
You're actually obliged to stay friends with everyone.
I love it. I love it when they start pulling the business apart, because then it's an insight into what's important to them.
Okay, interesting.
And that, for me, and this is the biggest thing I've found with people that we support selling on their own through the Six Steps program we've got, and us working as brokers, is that people, they'll take no for an answer, they'll get offended, they'll take things personally, they won't follow up enough. If you're going to sell on your own,
of the conversation.
Yeah, exactly that. And I had that conversation with a client yesterday, saying when they tell you they're not interested, that's when you start selling them the business. Before that, you're qualifying them and you're just getting to know them and you're making sure they're a good fit. As soon as they tell you no, right, get into it. What is it they don't like? They don't like the location? They don't like the rent? What is it? Let's deal with it. So, it's a fascinating process, but you have to be thick-skinned. You have to remove yourself from it emotionally if you're selling on your own, and you've got to be prepared. You've got to be prepared to have some very interesting and challenging conversations.
Yes, character forming. So, Paul, you mentioned a six-step program, and you've got a website, you've got a Facebook group, and we'll put links to all of these in the show notes today, but just tell us how people can connect up with you.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Ken. So the easiest way through the website, gsebusinessconsultants.com.au. There's information there about the services. The Facebook group's fairly easy to find, linked through to GSE as well. And the six steps to sale, again, that's on its own website, thesixstepstosale.com.au. That's the middle ground, I guess, between selling on your own and selling through a broker. So it's a guided program. And there's details about
the fitness program to look ready, to get yourself ready.
Yeah, it basically gives you what it does for full transparency. It's selling you advertising. So I'm selling people what they want and delivering what they need, which is support and resources to guide them, not only in addition to the advertising and qualifying inquiries, but guiding them through that process of negotiation through to settlement.
Mm. Wow. So interesting. So informative. Thanks, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Always good to chat about it. It's, as we said offline, it's an hour sometime. For me, I love this sort of thing. I could talk about it all day. It's such a fascinating process.
Thanks for joining me. I hope you're feeling inspired after listening to this episode. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app, and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with Ken Bergen on LinkedIn and on Twitter.